In China, UFOs are politically dangerous information. So those, that's the era of Mao, Chairman Mao. And during that period of time, you're talking 27 years, that China allowed only one truth. That was the party truth. And UFOs implied unknown forces beyond party control. And therefore, discussion of UFOs was explicitly treated as counter-revolutionary.
Joining me once again on the podcast, as promised, folks, to dive into the world of ufology from a Chinese perspective, I have the one and only Richard Dolan. Richard, welcome back.
Hi, Andy. Thanks for having me here. And I'm always happy to be on your program with your audience. You got great people
awesome.
Here.
You must do to come back, peek behind the curtain, folks. It may only be seconds since we finished the last recording, but it'll have been a few days in your world since that one passed. Maybe you're watching them back to back, who knows? But a big thank you to Richard for his time. Richard, we spent a lot of time, and we've always spent a lot of time talking about the Western lens on the UFO topic. The phenomenon is not American. Even I get folks commenting on the YouTube channel, Richard, about my accent not being from the States and everything like that. This is a worldwide phenomenon, and I think that's often overlooked. And in this day and age, it's particularly pertinent. I'd love to know if Roswell is the mythical starting point for many folks of the UFO topic or modern ufology. Let's talk about China. How does that begin?
Well, so, you know, a few things. I don't even speak Chinese. I am not a China expert in any reasonable way to put that. I have an interest in China. I have an interest in Chinese history, all of that. But that doesn't make me an expert. I do have a very high level of respect for the long, long continuity of Chinese civilization. I think this is a very important thing to say about these people who have a continuity going back, not just even 3,000 years from when, you know, Chinese writing really takes off, but even much longer than that. China has had a definite unified history for many, many thousands of years, even before it was called China. So it's a remarkable place that's had, maybe you could argue, some of the longest continuity of any kind of society. I mean, there's some other places in the world that have it as well. Aboriginal culture in Australia, the San people of Africa, sure. But look, the Chinese have a very, very, very long-lasting society. So that's one thing that I think is important just to recognize about China. Also, just today, China is clearly one of the most significant powers and countries in the world, and it's one of the most significant UFO or UAP countries in the world, very comparable to the United States in terms of the activity that seems to be going on there. Yet it remains very poorly understood in the West for a lot of reasons. We got the language barrier. There's the political opacity, we can say, of the Chinese political leadership, very strong state control over most narratives. The thing is, with UFOs in China, one thing that I have learned in my own study, I went into my own like deep dive into this a little over a year ago, and UFOs in China are not just anomalous phenomena. It's different. UFOs and the phenomenon itself and everything around it intersects directly with ideology, with social order, and with national security, as it does in the U.S., but it very strongly ideologically in a way that's not quite the same in the West. In China, UFOs are politically dangerous information. I would go so far as to say that. And we'll have to come back to that, and I will try to unpack that. But China, you know, has a very, well, let's talk about there's a couple of basic phases that I see when I look at Chinese ufology or the China's UFO story. You got, in the modern era, let's talk about the Maoist era. So Mao Zedong takes charge of China in 1949. He dies in 1976. So that's the year of Mao Zedong, Chairman Mao. And during that period of time, you're talking 27 years, that China allowed only one truth. That was the party truth. And UFOs implied unknown forces beyond party control. And therefore, discussion of UFOs was explicitly treated as counter-revolutionary. So during the 1950s and 60s and most of the 70s, it was banned. It was illegal. And so sightings occurred anyway. We have a number of that have come down to us from the Maoist period. But for the most part, they were deeply suppressed. They circulated very quietly and really only emerged, for the most part, decades later. So that's the first phase. The second phase, you could say, would be the kind of opening and explosion. So when after Mao died in 76, took a year or two, but by 1978, you have an absolute explosion of ufology in China. And this coincides with Deng Xiaoping's leadership, where he saw the need to open China intellectually and economically in many ways to the West. It had fallen vastly behind the West in so many ways. Deng saw this. And so you see this window into opening of intellectual permissiveness that was allowed. And you really, it was 1978 that you get the first official acknowledgement that UFOs could even be discussed in China. So from that, you get this rapid surge in sightings and public interest. It went from a very low level officially to extremely important. You get the formation of the China UFO Research Association, CURA. It's kind of semi-official, still definitely embedded in the Chinese bureaucracy, but it expanded nationwide very rapidly. So what you have with early Chinese ufology in that period, it's very serious, it's very empirical, it's supported by scientists rather than ridiculed by scientists. What ends up happening is, though, is that whole scene became very volatile and reached a crisis by 1999. So what really happened is that UFO research becomes, you have it splitting off into two directions. You've got the kind of the official state-sponsored version, which was very like scientific materialism and everything that you'd expect from that. And then you've got the grassroots Chinese ufology, which is totally different. And really grew, it seems to me, in tandem with movements like Qigong, and then most notoriously the Falun Gong, which was a deeply charismatic movement that, to the state's perspective, seemed very superstitious, right? But even more than that, was in this independent belief system. So you have a kind of spiritual explosion in China, coincident with an explosion in UFO interest. And just like we've seen in the West, you get these charismatic individuals who state that they're in contact with extraterrestrial intelligences and the like. You get this in China. And so that the Falun Gong movement during the 1990s, which had very definite beliefs on aliens and not really happy beliefs. These were beliefs of kind of alien infiltration and dangers from these human-looking aliens who were embedded in society. This is part of the belief structure of Falun Gong. But it was also deeply integrated with the practice of Qigong and other forms of mental discipline and meditation. And it became so popular. By most estimates that I was able to read, I think it became more popular than the Communist Party of China itself. And they started having these massive outdoor Qigong demonstrations where people would all get together and do Qigong exercises together. It's huge, huge crowds. I mean, unlike anything you see in the West. So all of this was a massive movement. And the organization CURA, C-U-R-A, the Chinese Association for UFOs, saw this as not just a threat to them and their approach to UFOs, but the party itself saw this movement as way too much of a threat. So by the late 90s, the official tolerance of that movement just totally collapsed. And you see a serious crackdown of the Falun Gong in 1999. It was brutal. I mean, really brutal. And some of these people were killed and sent away and never heard from again and this type of thing. And you see after that, that Chinese ufology essentially splits into these two distinct worlds. The grassroots ufology in China still exists, but it's a little more low key. They've got to be much more careful. And even Chinese expats in other countries, I've spoken to a few of them if they're interested in UFOs, and they are very careful about what they say publicly because they still have family in China and they are concerned about saying something that goes against the party. Mm-hmm. So that's a broad strokes breakdown. There's much, much more to say. There's a lot of interesting sightings that that have come down to us through the, I mean, there's even some ancient stories that I don't really know what you take of them, but certainly from the modern era, right on through the Mao period, you get that. And then, you know, we could talk about the military dimension, that is the People's Liberation Army, the Chinese Army, which I think is very sophisticated from what I can see in their handling of UFO data. So there's a lot going on here. It depends on where you want to ask.
Yeah, let's start at the beginning because that's a great overview. And I was looking through all the questions I've got, and they should be relevant to everything you've said there. And I've done some looking into that research you've done that was fantastic, like you say, so comprehensive. You looked at those ancient Chinese accounts. What are those like? And it reminds me, of course, of we would look at hieroglyphics in pyramids or cave paintings that may or may not depict unusual aerial phenomena. What sort of ancient records do you see in China, and do they hold as much weight or merit?
Well, there's some pretty interesting Chinese stories that go back many centuries that are interesting to me. In fact, I actually wrote about one in my first volume of USO history. I think it was a story from like the year 1060. I could pull it off my shelf here, but it's the Pearl on the Lake story, where you have a Chinese witness claiming that there was this flaming, glowing object over this small body of water in inland China. That it was quite an impressive phenomenon. The thing is, it's a 1,000-year-old story. It was related shortly after it allegedly happened. And it could be true. It could totally be true. You get a few interesting stories like that. There was a story a number of years ago about the so-called Dropa stones, which I'm not a believer in. This is allegedly, though, are these discs that have said to have some writing on them. Mm. And supposedly someone translated them, and they're like, I think, 12,000 or more years old. How you could decipher such a thing is beyond me. There was no written language at that time. It's all just nonsense. So I don't, you know, there's a lot of that in the ancient Chinese folklore as well. But there are some, you know, there's ancient sightings that are comparable or even superior to anything you get in Europe from the same period of time. And not just China, but Japan too. They both were literate societies that were able to take records. So you have some interesting sightings. I don't really know if that's all that incredible to dissect. What I would say, there are some very good, there's a photograph. I should have sent this to you beforehand. You could show your people, but there's a photograph from 1942 in a region known as Tianjin. That's northern China, not far from Beijing. It's a major port city. Dense population. So during 1942, you still have a Japanese occupation of that region of China. And there is a photograph that a Japanese officer purchased from a Chinese vendor, apparently just in the street, and took it home. And he died, you know, years later, but his grandson got the photograph and publicized it. And you could search it out. It's not that difficult to find the Tianjin 1942 photo. And It strikes me as a potentially legit photograph. You've got people on the ground looking up. One person's pointing at it. It's a flying saucer. You're doing your search on it. TIANJIN, Tianjin 1942 photograph. You're probably looking at it.
Yeah, I've found it. Yep. I'll put it up on the screen during the video.
I think it's a legit potential, I would say probable, photographic evidence over an urban center in China, 1942. I mean, the object that's seen there it's not identifiable as any kind of aircraft that I can think of from the 1940s.
Mm.
Anyway, it was in the possession of a Japanese officer at the time, or a Japanese soldier who bought it. So, and then, you know, there's other sightings that have come down to us through the Mao years. Some of them are very, very, very interesting. One from the late 50s from central China, a place called Huangqi, Hubei province. It's a big industrial corridor by the Yangtze River there. A lot of iron and steel workers were witnesses, apparently, to a classic disc-shaped object. I think it was 1957. There was a lot of sound. There was maneuvering. A lot of these came to us through a Chinese researcher by the name of Paul Dong, D-O-N-G. He, by the way, he was a Qigong practitioner, as I recall. But he wrote a very, very good book. It still can be found, called UFOs Over Modern China, I think. He wrote it in the early 1980s. And what he did was he did all the legwork of collecting these various Chinese UFO stories that were available, that a lot of the Kuro organization had collected and a lot of other places had collected. Chinese ufology was very active. And he, thank God, like, he wrote these down so that researchers like us here in the West can have access to them. That was one that Paul Dong put in his book. There was one, a really interesting one, a military one from 1968, not far from Korea's northeastern coastal China. It's a place called Dalian, I believe. You have military witnesses in 1968, radar, communications interference. The base was put on immediate military alert, and they saw a classic kind of a UFO. There's no photograph of this, but there was an illustration. I think Paul Dong had it in his book. It's kind of interesting. But you get a lot of these types of things. There was a photograph, I think, from 1961 from central China near the Yellow River Basin, and an engineer took several photographs of a hovering disc. That photograph is in Paul Dong's book. Maybe you can find it, 1961. If not, I'll send it to you, and you can put it up for the people. But that's a pretty interesting early documentation case. So from somewhere in central China. So you have a few of these, and then there was a significant wave of sightings in China in the late 70s, 1976, 77. Over in the West, so there is the province called the Xinjiang province, far western China, where they did nuclear testing and missile development and all of that. You had a bunch of meteorological observers where an object appeared on multiple consecutive nights. And then the following year, 1977, in southwestern China, I'm sure I'm mangling all the pronunciations here, so forgive me, but the Sichuan province, across this entire province, it's a very large area, multiple cities, astronomers were some of the witnesses, a massive regional wave of sightings. So that's, we're not talking folklore here. These are, these were well documented, and they, a lot of them occurred exactly where the Chinese state was most sensitive. You're talking, weapons testing areas and the like. So the Chinese military, like, there's no question in my mind, had to become interested in this from the beginning, because they had their share of military encounters as well. You get recurrent features across decades of, like, radar detection, electronic interference, military alerts. Like, this we don't have a lot of these cases, but they happen throughout different decades. So it certainly seems to me that this is a recurring theme, that the People's Liberation Army has been tracking these for a long time. And I strongly believe that public ufology in China, to say much less the rest of the world, only sees a fraction of that data. And within China now, since the crackdown of the Falun Gong in 1989, public discussion of UFOs is really, it's a narrowly constricted conversation that goes on. There's no more talk about conspiracies or cover-ups. You don't get that in China.
Mm.
And you have a lot of Chinese UFO organizations, but they all seem to have they have to answer to someone in the party or someone in the state. And what the military knows, there's a, I studied this when I went through this last year, and I should have reminded myself, but essentially what I can say is there are three levels of how the Chinese military seems to extract or analyze UFO reports. So you have the grassroots level among many, many, many Chinese UFO organizations that exist in different regions. And they appear to filter upwards to these regional centers where the Chinese military actually assesses and filters through them. And those, the best sightings of those get filtered to the kind of analytical stations that they seem to have. It seems to be a very more sophisticated system than what I think exists in the U.S. That's the way it seemed to me. A very logical system.
Let me ask, Richard, under Mao, you mentioned that UFOs were effectively suppressed. Was that due to narrative control? Was that due to superstition culturally? What was the reason for that suppression?
Predominantly in the Maoist tradition of communism in China. You may know this as well, but that was an extremely intolerant state in terms of challenges to the party authority.
Mm.
It was absolutely not permitted at all. Think Stalin and probably turn that up a little bit and you get Mao.
Yeah.
So it was a very, very strong. So no threats at all were permitted to the primacy of the state as the arbiter of truth and the holder of truth and knowledge. And so when you have this unknown phenomenon, implicitly, you're going to have people wondering, well, who's behind this? Is this the Americans? And even that was not something that was permitted to be discussed in Mao's China, that the Americans would have the ability to do this. And in fact, the Americans did not have the ability to engage in sightings in the 1950s and 60s over central China. I don't see anything in the American technology that would have permitted that. So it's just a matter of not permitting challenges to authority, to the state. And keep in mind, you know, from 1966 until Mao's death 10 years later, China was embroiled in the most, wrenching turning inside out of its society possible, known as the Cultural Revolution, which was a brutal, it's something that China, how do you get over something like that? This is not something that really allows for open discussion even to this day, because too many families were destroyed, too many lives were wrecked by this. And so in an environment like that, you're not going to be exploring an intellectual curiosity such as UFOs during the Cultural Revolution. That's just not going to fly. It's not going to work.
Are they talking about the same types of craft as well? Is it still saucers? Is it still cigars? Is it still triangles?
Yep. Yeah, same. I didn't see any from what I could see. And I would encourage people to find a copy of Paul Dong's book. It's probably to this day the best book on, the limitation is it goes up to the 1980s, the early 80s at that. But it's an excellent book. It's an excellent book in English, easy to read. It's great. And what you see is, yeah, the patterns are the same. There's no difference. A disc-shaped craft, absolutely. You get cigar-shaped craft. You get a number of, there is one where there's like, people remember the Norwegian spiral from about 15 years ago. This really, really weird thing. That may have been completely prosaic. I'm not saying it wasn't, but there were similar things in China during the 70s and 80s. These kinds of bizarre phenomenon that just hard to make sense of. And they could be rocket launches, some of them that went wrong. But yeah, the sightings are, in fact, one of the things that struck me about Chinese UFO sightings is how comparable they are to what you see in the West.
There was a sighting in China. I wrote about it in my book. Is it Zhoushan Airport? Hopefully I'm saying it properly. Where
is that
there was
the one
a really
2011 or 2010?
Yeah, it's more of a modern sighting. Where again, right, there's very limited information from it because it's still modern day China. But
that's an interesting one, though. I thought that was an interesting sighting.
Again, happened at an airport. Closed the airport down. These reports come out few and far between. You've mentioned some of the older cases. Is there a peak time for sightings in China? It seems to be, I think in reading through the articles and your research, after Mao's death, there's a period, again, you mentioned when we spoke about USOs, there's a USO flurry between the late 60s through the 70s into the 80s. What's that time period look like in China?
It could be exactly the same. That's the crazy thing. I wish we had more sources to investigate this. But what is undeniable, and you have to ask, is this simply the result of research being allowed to do its thing? Could be. But the late 1970s were just crazy town, crazy times. Many, many, many sightings. And again, you see this in Paul Dong's research. Just an enormous number. So now, is that just because researchers were now alert to this thing happening and they were more receptive of reports? I'm sure that is part of it. The real question is that all of it? The impression that I got from, because there are some more contemporary Chinese researchers that are out there today, and it's really hard to know what we're really dealing with, but I've come across claims, absolutely, that all through the 1980s and 1990s, UFO sightings were extremely high in China, extremely high. And if that's true, and I don't really see any reason to think it isn't, I would have to suspect they're still high today, but it's a different environment today. So you don't get the kind of open grassroots freewheeling Chinese researchers. I mean, for the most part, you don't. There's a few people out there who seem to be pretty engaged, but they're not like leading movements or anything like that, you know. So I get the idea that China is still very active with UFO sightings, most of which we don't encounter. But that's only a supposition I'm making. What I can definitely say is when I read Paul Dong's book, it's obvious massive numbers of sightings through the 1970s and late 70s and early 80s, no question. And then you have claims from other Chinese researchers that continued through the 80s. We just don't have a good record of that in the West, unfortunately, and through the 90s. But I tend to believe that that's the case.
Coming through that time period where we saw an uptick in cases reporting interest in the topic through the 80s before things went quiet again, was there again any similarities of whistleblowers coming forward? Was there a Bob Lazar in China? Was there anything like that to that level, or was it still too much for someone to come out and speak so openly?
No, you don't get a Lazar coming out of China. You do get some claims, however. One, I think, was from a retired soldier. I'm trying to remember his name, but he claimed like he had long-term alien contact. So you get a lot of contactee type things. You don't get anyone that I'm aware of saying the Chinese government is hiding technology. Yep. I spoke some years ago with Sun Shi Li, who is, I think he may still be alive. He's a Chinese researcher. And he, I asked him about crash retrievals, and he said, well, we think there may have been one in 1999, but he says there's so little that we can get on it. So there's, you get the idea that there's some level of a slight willingness to peek into the military and the official cover up, if you will. But I don't really feel that they've gotten very far with that. You do have individual researchers. There's the one whose name I can remember, Zhang Jingping, who he's been going since the 1990s. I think he's still active. He uses scientific techniques and tools. But he's really into contactees. This is a very big part of Chinese grassroots ufology. Is really big on contactees. There's a lot of like combination of using scientific empirical methods, but with a very major metaphysical overlay that's part of a lot of grassroots Chinese ufology that I find very interesting. A lot of claims of abductions and physical contact encounters with other beings. You get that. And some of those cases, I think were very like strongly investigated and defended by Chinese researchers. So you get that onboard healing experiences and all of this type of thing. But as far as like what you're asking, Lazar type stuff, that is, as far as I am aware, it seems absent from the cultural discussion. I could easily be missing this though. I could easily have missed that one.
No, it's a hard subject to research because I've tried myself in the past, but do you think even a public appetite for this topic? Say they did loosen, you know, the lips, modern day China, to start discussing UFOs. What would that public appetite look like, do you think?
It would be very interesting to see how this would play out. Like, as I mentioned, when the Falun Gong reached their peak of basically terrorizing the government. Government was terrified of them by the late 90s. And that's prompted the crackdown. So 1999 was a different world than what we have today. And China, yes, it's authoritarian. Yes, they have the social credit system. And yes, like there's all kinds of ways to manage the population. But the Chinese people are very different than they were 30 years ago. They're very sophisticated. And they have opinions and they have their own social media. And yes, it's constrained in certain ways, but they do express their opinions on a lot of matters. This I know. And so you have to wonder if this subject were somehow to catch fire in China, how would the government manage it? And to me, this would be a real threat to the government. They would absolutely want to manage public discussion on aliens and UFOs and everything related to that. So how would they do it would be the question. Would they invoke social credit score types of penalties on people? Maybe. Maybe it'd be more than that. You know, I have to think that they would have a lot of leverage over their citizens, whether financially or in terms of, you know, restricting their actual freedoms to do things. So it's not impossible that this subject catches fire, but you know, we talk about the Great Wall of China. Well, there's the Great Firewall of China, and that's their digital their digital protections that they have. And so they're very, for the most part, pretty efficient at keeping out what they want to keep out. And so far managing their society the way that they, the party, feel that it should be managed.
It's a very secretive society, and I think everyone knows that with even the most base level knowledge of China.
They're secretive with a remarkable sense of cultural unity.
Yep.
Like this really has to be recognized. Like, it's easy for us in the West to criticize a Chinese totalitarian government. And yes, I mean, we can criticize it. I can. You can. But it's a society that still believes in itself. It's a society that still identifies itself in a certain way as a certain cultural unity that you really don't see in the West.
Yeah.
So it's very different in that sense. And it's a strength. I mean, I think it's undeniable that you have to see it as a strength. So that's one thing that the party can probably continue to rely on, is that sense of China as an entity, and a sense that, you know, the people can believe in the society. Plus, on top of that, as long as that party can continue to produce economic growth, which it's doing, they will probably, I'm assuming, they will continue to have enough support by far to guide that society in the way that they feel that they want to, I would imagine.
One of the biggest interesting aspects of the topic in the United States, in the UK, in Europe, in the West, is the idea of crash retrieval programs. More and more popular, people like Jake Barber coming forward, looking to Jake's story, what you will. I know the Skywatcher story at the moment is one that has a lot of raised eyebrows, conspicuous by their absence and silence after a lot of big promises over a year ago now. But it's still an element of the topic that is speculated on that we don't know a whole lot about just by its nature. Is that the same when it comes to China and any potential crash retrieval programs and how those might operate?
Yeah, well, as I kind of hinted earlier, I mean, there's at least, you have the vague potential of a crash retrieval maybe happening in 1999. As I recall, what Sun Shili said is that it was in the northern region. But yeah, that's all guesswork. I would suspect that China has some serious data on this phenomenon, and they may have some technology to work with. I mean, look, China has come a long way in their technological sophistication over the last 30 plus years. It's light years difference. They are, in many ways, they are the most sophisticated nation in the world technologically in a lot of areas. Many areas. They've surpassed the West in a lot of very important areas in terms of engineering, in terms of material science, and I have no doubt a lot of other things. So they have an outstanding scientific infrastructure with which to study this type of technology. And something else to keep in mind, China and Russia in the last decade particularly have gotten very, very close. This is a real backfiring of U.S. policy, both under Biden and Trump, where they really, everything they tried to do just went opposite. And they tried to split China and Russia from each other. And it just only, all they've done is they've brought them into a kind of almost symbiosis in terms of their nations and in their security structures as well. You know, in terms of energy, in terms of military technology, like those two nations share a lot with each other. And there's no question Russia has a very, very substantial background in dealing with UFOs, equal to that of the United States military. I think the Russian military is probably equal in that way. They have a long history of this. So I would not be surprised at this point if they've shared some information along those lines. Again, that's guessing, but it's not implausible in my opinion.
One of the arguments I often hear about the US or Russia or China not having successfully reverse engineered this incredible technology, let's just use the Tic Tac as an example, is that if one of these superpowers had a Tic Tac, they could put a nuclear weapon over any city, any capital city in the world at seconds notice. No one could do anything about it. They would become the dominant superpower. They would, quote unquote, win. Is that right? And what would that look like if China did manage to reverse engineer one of these craft to that level?
Yeah, it's a great question. I suspect they haven't reverse engineered. The actual Tic Tac encounter from 2004, I would bet the farm that was not Chinese technology or Russian technology for that matter. And I don't think it was U.S. either. I think that was an independent, you know, keep in mind the Tic Tac was seen in conjunction with dozens of other similar objects over a 2-week period preceding that.
People forget that quite a lot.
Yeah, that's right. Playing. And also that there was, I think, probably a very, very large USO underwater object in connection with that Tic Tac that has been discussed. And I think was probably the case. So you're talking a very sophisticated operation there. But to your question, I think it's a reasonable conclusion that we haven't made that kind of that level of a breakthrough, or if we've made the breakthrough, maybe not knowing exactly how to use the technology reliably, if possible, or in a way that wouldn't be disruptive to the world system. By that, I simply mean, look at it from the U.S. point of view. Let's say the U.S. has successfully reverse engineered certain aspects of ET technology. The real question is, would you use them in your geopolitical struggles? You really might not, because you have to ask, this is a cynical perspective, but what is the purpose of all the U.S. wars that the U.S. has engaged in over the decades? Is it for geopolitical dominance, or is it to enrich their military-industrial complex? Which a lot of it, I think, is the latter. I honestly do believe that. You've got a lot of groups that make a lot of money off of these weapons platforms. And if you're winning your wars anyway, you know, if it's 1990 and you're doing the Persian Gulf War, well, maybe you don't need to bring in a Tic Tac. You know, you're bringing in stealth. That's good enough. You don't need to. So you might use that technology for other purposes. This is where I developed the idea of a breakaway civilization years ago. I thought, well, if you've got this technology, would you necessarily use it in geopolitical warfare, especially if you don't need it? No, you might use it for other purposes, though. I mean, a simple example of this was back in the 1980s, 1986, when the U.S. bombed Libya. People forget this. They tried to assassinate Gaddafi that year, and they failed. And for that attack, they used, I think it was F-111s. They had and didn't use the then operational stealth fighter, because, and this is known, its existence was considered too important to risk its exposure on an operation that didn't meet the criteria for using it. So we do have, you know, you've got criteria for using certain weapons systems, presumably. And it strikes me as at least possible, maybe plausible, that UFO tech that we develop might be considered too important for mere geopolitical maneuvering. You might use it for other things, maybe dealing with them or doing other things that are outside the system. It's just a theory. So, but for the Russians and Chinese, you might think, would they use it for certain purposes? Well, that's assuming that Russia and China both have global expansionist ideologies, and I'm not really sure that they do. They're managing their own society, and they've got powerful economic relations with much of the rest of the world, which I think they're quite happy with.
We have talked a few times now in previous interviews and shows around what a US-led disclosure would look like. How would that impact China if tomorrow, again, we had President Trump or the next US president tell the world unequivocally, yeah, we are not alone? How does that impact China, and what do they do off the back of that?
Honestly, if Trump were to do a disclosure of UFOs, I could almost believe he would do it in order to mess with China, like to help destabilize China. He would have to, because he would. Like that, I don't want to be giving advice here on how to destabilize China. But the fact is, I mean, I don't know if UFOs would be sufficient to do it. It would have to grow into a mass movement the way it did 30 years ago. But it did happen 30 years ago, so it could happen today. It's not impossible. And a genuine UFO disclosure, I would be very confident to say this, would not be welcome in the Chinese leadership. I don't know if it's the same with Russia. I don't think it's the same with Russia. I think Russia is different, very different. But with China, you have a very definite rule by a party that's still, yes, I mean, they're capitalists, but they're still communists. They're both. And they still elicit control as much ideological control over their society as they can have. And so UFO disclosure would not be welcome, and it would be disruptive. To what extent is the real question, but it would not make the Chinese leadership happy. I'm quite convinced of that. And it could be like a card that an American president could play in the global geopolitical game. The problem is, you know, just as we talked in our previous conversation about Obama and Trump and the whole UFO conversation that's happening these days, you have a lot of people in the world that really think Trump's kind of lost it when he's talking about these UFOs. They're like, you know, they're not convinced that he's onto anything. So it would be necessary for any president, particularly for Donald Trump, if he's to make a disclosure statement, he's got to bring the goods. He's got to bring enough evidence that will be persuasive to the rest of the world. I mean, I strongly suspect that we're not really talking about Russia, but Vladimir Putin, I think, is deeply, I'm convinced he's very interested in UFOs.
Yeah.
He was a, protege is too strong a word, but he was a great admirer of Yuri Andropov, who was former head of the Soviet Union in the late, just before Gorbachev, and had been head of the KGB, and was definitely interested in UFOs. And we know that Putin has Andropov's, all of his old files and records. And Andropov, it was not just a casual interest. I think he was very interested in it. So, and he was a very serious man, Yuri Andropov. And I strongly suspect that Putin, who actively admires Andropov, probably has a strong interest in UFOs. And then you have the statement by his, for a while, his number two, Dmitry Medvedev, who also was president of Russia for a number of years, who made a statement at Davos back in the early 2000s that to a journalist who was interviewing him, who laughed as he talked, but I think he was dead serious when he said, when you become president of Russia, you're given two briefcases. One has all the nuclear information, and one has all the information on aliens living in this country. And I don't think he was talking about illegal aliens.
Mm. Yeah.
The journalist laughed when he was saying this, because I think it was reflexive, kind of like, oh, you must be joking. But Medvedev is not, he can troll. He's very active on Twitter these days, and he's a good troll. But he looked totally deadpan, totally serious, came out of nowhere. So I think the Russians know. So if Trump or some other president were to make a disclosure statement, I think in the right circles, people would know he's telling the truth. But there would still have to be a very wide circle of, let's say, the intellectual elites, the scientists. They would need to be persuaded. You're not just going to be able to make a statement like this and be able to get away with it without much of the so-called educated world ridiculing you. So Trump would have to bring the goods in a significant way. And that would be very interesting to see. Otherwise, it could be a public relations disaster. I mean, a total disaster if you don't do it right.
I'd like to pick a bit more into this with the listener questions we've got, Richard, because you've been with me for a long time today. And there's a lot of questions to get through that I won't get to this time, folks. But Richard will be back on soon, hopefully, to talk about that second USO book. So I will keep some behind. But a couple to pick from here on China specifically. Andy, not me, but cool name, says, I'd be curious to know if Richard has any information on the commonly reported appearances of beings in Chinese close encounter reports. Are they consistent with descriptions given by experiencers in the West? I'm interested in the extent to which cultural expectations might affect our perception of the phenomenon.
Yeah, it's a great question. I don't know if I could answer that precisely either. There are statements of beings. And by the way, when there's communication, they speak in the local Chinese language that is there, which wouldn't be a surprise. There are definitely sightings of human-looking figures. Like, definitely you get that, which you get in the West. So And also, there are sightings. I'm thinking of one. There's a famous one of a couple of truck drivers in the late 70s. One's following the other. They both saw like these very short beings on the road ahead of them, apparently much shorter than a normal human being. But I'm not saying that they were the same as gray aliens. I don't think there was enough description to make that case. So you get a lot of human-looking alien claims. And as far as other appearances, I should probably hold off because I'm not sure that I have a certain answer about that. Definitely, there's a lot of cases of contact. And the ones that I can think about are of beings that are essentially, roughly speaking, human-looking.
Mm.
Yeah.
Dave Smether sent a few questions, so thanks, Dave, but I've picked this one for you, Richard. Dave says, I have persistently heard rumours that China has made bigger advances in UAP research engineering than the US anticipated, and this has caught the US by surprise. It seems to be more linked to AI, materials, and drones. What has Richard heard on this? And does he think... does he think the recent inexplicable drone flaps over US military infrastructure in the US and Europe over the last 2 years is potentially linked?
To the last point, I don't think that they are probably linked to China at all. And I only say this for China's international political posture at that time. I think no. And then you look at the geography too. Those sightings were primarily over the Atlantic in the eastern U.S. coast. That's a very difficult place for China to get major access to have a presence by which presumably they would launch these drones. I mean, unless the drones have the ability to fly over the world in an instant, which I don't think I haven't seen any evidence that that's the case. So I don't look at China as the source of the mystery drones that we talked about a little over a year ago. It's my own opinion. But I do think that China has very likely made tremendous strides in its ability, A, to analyze genuine UFO reports to make material science advances based on this. I have very little doubt that they can do that. I was saying earlier, in kind of a vague way, that the Chinese military seems to have a very logical three-level system by which to extract good UFO reports from the public and to be able to do analysis and follow up on, let's say, the cream of the crop. So I think that the Chinese military is actively sifting through UFO data. And a lot of those reports are coming through the military channels anyway. And they don't let out anything that they get in. So I think they've got a very significant database, and I would be surprised if they were not actively studying it and working on developments. Plus, then there's the AI aspect of it, which clearly they have excellent leading edge AI, I have no doubt. So I'm sure that they're making developments as we speak, as are the Russians, I have no doubt. Russia is easier to look at these days in terms of, because you can see what they're doing in the war, and they are absolutely making massive, massive technological developments as a result of that war. But China, too, I have no doubt, is making significant developments.
Separately on that, we've not touched on it yet, Richard. This is one from me as a listener and fan of yours. Have you seen the three-body problem, the Chinese version?
Well, I saw the three-body problem, and it's based out of China. It's China, so, and I think there's a sequel that I haven't seen. I don't know if that's out yet.
So there's the version on Netflix, which is basically the US-centric, based in London version of Friends, but with, yeah.
I think that's the one that I must have seen. I didn't see the Chinese version. Well, I'll look for it. If there's subtitles that I can read, I'll follow along. I thought it was great. I thought the three-body problem was quite interesting. It was very well done, the version I saw.
Highly recommend the Chinese one. It's on YouTube. Put it this way, it's subtitled. I think it's in about 24 parts on YouTube.
Wow.
All at about 45 minutes to an hour long. It's far more accurate.
Serious?
To the book. Yeah. It's amazing. And it would have been very easy for me, who turns off a lot of TV shows really quickly, to come away from it. I ended up paying for some. So I don't know if it's still the same. I'll send you the link, but you would get episode 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Mm-hmm. 6 and 7 you would have to pay for. I think it's also on Amazon Prime. So okay. I was actually jumping between free episodes and then paying for episodes on Amazon Prime, going back to the free episodes 8, 9, 10, back to paying for number 11. It's brilliant. And
it's a Chinese production then. It's out of China.
Yeah. I watched that first before the Netflix version came on, and the Netflix one was incredibly disappointing. Because I'd seen that one, and I'm not the guy who likes to do that. I've read the book and it's better, or I've seen the Chinese production with subtitles.
It's usually better than
it goes into so much more depth and detail than a 6 or 8 part series does, and that also has a second series greenlit. So highly recommend that.
I'm on it. Tracy and I like to watch a lot of those things together, so we'll I'll tell her about that. That'll be a marathon session, but we'll go in for it.
Yeah, it's really good. Odd Eggle. What I will add, though, it's funny when you get to the parts that have some English in them, they're clearly like English translated into how the Chinese would say it. So the English sounds like a small child is speaking, even though it's an adult, because the words just don't, you wouldn't say it like that, but it's just so simplified and that's quite funny. But yeah, incredible series. Odd Eggle says, if the Chinese Communist Party ever chose to acknowledge UFOs publicly, and I think you touched on this, how do you think they would frame the narrative? Scientific discovery, national security issue, or ideological alignment? I think you mentioned they're very data driven on this.
That's a really good question, because this is different, from the 1990s. I think it would seem odd to me if the Chinese government were to say, yes, these aliens think just the same way that we do. They believe in communism. I mean, maybe they would say that, but I can't imagine that. I think that they would, if they were forced into an acknowledgement of this in some way, I just have to think that they would do it in as grudging and non fiery way as possible. So just to say, this is a scientific phenomenon. We are going through this very carefully. We are at all times, our priority is the safety and thriving of the Chinese people. Like, I imagine they would say something like that. And probably, I have to think, implicitly or explicitly say to the people, this is in our hands. We're dealing with it. You don't need to worry about it. We've got this. Like, I would imagine they would say something like that. And that could work.
How do you think, conversely then, how do you think the US would react to China leading the way? Say China made some sort of announcement for whatever reason first. Yeah. How does the US react to that?
You know, Americans love to think of themselves as like, we're the leaders of the world. How dare they disclose before us? I've heard people say this. I used to have arguments years ago with Steve Bassett over disclosure, and his argument, whichever was the president at the time, didn't matter. He would say, well, his legacy would be, we have to do this before the Russians do it or the Chinese. But really, if it were actually to happen, if the Chinese were, or more to the point, I think if the Russians were to, because I would say both would be unlikely, but I would say the Russians would be more likely than the Chinese. But if either of those nations were to disclose ahead of the US, I would bet you this, they would have thought it out way more than the American political establishment would think it through. Those leaders, whether you're talking about Xi Jinping or Putin, or the people around them, because they're all part of a culture. These are not people who think through these things in a superficial way. They would think this through in all of its strategic implications, and they would not do this in a trivial way. The way Trump has made his statement strikes many people as trivial. whether it is or isn't is another question, but it, I mean, puts it out in the Truth Social post. For God's sake, you'd never see the Chinese or Russian leadership making announcements like that, you know, like truly from the hip. That's not how they would do it. They would be very measured. It would be deeply thought out. They would not be messing around. So, and they would be, I have no doubt in my mind, they would be thinking of the diplomatic implications. They would be thinking of the financial implications. They would, it would all be on their mind. So they would have a plan, and then they would follow through on that plan too, because that's something that the Chinese and the Russians both do. They plan and they follow through. Whether you like them or don't like them, they follow through on their plans. And they have long-term plans as well, and they follow through on those. Think of like the Belt and Road Initiative, for example. I mean, this is something that's years in the making. Or the whole BRICS Alliance. This is something they've cultivated for many, many years and grown and grown and grown. And it's becoming now a force to be reckoned with. So these are nations with political cultures that are experienced in long-term planning. And they don't talk loud. They're not loud talkers like the Americans are. So when they do say something, if they do, you can probably bet they mean it.
You know, Richard, I've got a largely American audience that listen to this, believe it or not. And my biggest gripe with America is how many sporting championships they refer to as the world champions when only those American teams can play. It's something that really gets on mine and a lot of folks in the UK's nerves. So, yeah, no offense, folks, but in the US, maybe relook at that one. From Joe. Joe says, in light of the recent Obama comments and the rumor of a disclosure speech on the 8th of July, what are Richard's thoughts on whether this will happen or not?
And whose disclosure speech on the 8th of July?
So Obama's comments, and there's rumors, and this is very spurious. It's come from a UK-based source who's saying he has anonymous connections in the US.
That's complete bullshit.
Disclosure speech on the 8th of July, yeah. Basically.
I thought that was supposed to be May 1st. I didn't think July.
No, the July 8th has been the date now for a while.
All right. Well, anyway, go on. Finish the question. I didn't mean to disparage
No. Yeah, you've answered the middle part of the question about China and Russia being happy with the US announcing, but also, would there be some agreement from the UN for Trump to make this speech, or do we think Trump would just do it as he wants to be the one to become famous in history for making this speech? But it's safe to say you call BS on the whole 8th of July disclosure speech coming.
I cannot. First of all, the source on that, I caught the guy's name and I'd never heard of him before. He's described as a UFO researcher.
Mark Christopher Lee.
Who is this? I mean, I know. It sounds very tabloidy to me. And how's he going to have a contact within the Trump White House? How does he do that? I would love to know. I don't believe that for an instant. It just seems utterly ridiculous, frankly. Now, if it happens, then I'll go on your show and I'll make my public apology, but I'm not betting on that's going
to
happen.
I think you'll have to go on one of his documentaries if it happens rather than come on this show.
Sure. No, look, how many predictions have we been handed over many years, like disclosures right around the corner, this speech, that speech. I remember back in 2008 when Obama got elected, people were like, Obama's going to make a disclosure announcement. It's like, where are you getting this from? No, it never stops. It's an endless just churning through, same old. But anyway, I missed some of the other parts of the question because I got all over the Mark Christopher thing.
No, largely that was it around if he makes that. And then the last part was around, do you think if he was going to do it, the UN have to make an agreement and whatnot, or would Trump just go for it?
Trump would just go for it. He's not going to give a crap about the UN.
Hmm.
Whatever else, like he doesn't think much of the UN. That is obvious.
Yeah.
Just he doesn't think much of the European Union. That is quite obvious. And by the way, regarding the EU, for good reason, I'll just say. But forgetting the UN, also, I don't think he thinks very highly of it. So. Yeah, I think he would just do it. And I think a lot of times the whole Trump ego thing is, it can be overplayed a bit. You know, people have to remember that as the U.S. president, you are deeply constrained by many, many factors. And it's not all about ego, even though it may seem like it. It's not all about your own whim. You're steering a huge ship that's got a lot of other people that you can't just snap your fingers and make them do what you want them to do. And whether your name is Trump or Biden or Obama or Bush or whatever. So, but there is an ego element to Trump, obviously. And, you know, it's not difficult to see that he would want to, he'd be happy to jump out on that if he could make it work. The thing is, again, you know, he's smart enough to know not to play with fire in terms of UFO stuff. Like, he's really never made a statement that definitive about this. And I think he knows it would be very unwise to do that. You start, especially him, you know, he's got the media already going after him for everything. He's always going to be attacked. So if he starts talking about aliens, he really has to find a way to back that up, or it would be very foolish for him to delve into that. So he needs to come with the goods. And I just seriously doubt that he would be willing to do that. But if anyone's going to surprise us, it'll be him. He's got the capacity to surprise us.
Yeah, I don't disagree. And I think come that 8th of July, we will probably hear that things changed and things moved, as always happens in this topic. And we've got a few dates that have been promised for various things this year as well. So let's see how those unfold. But Richard, thank you very much for that look into ufology in China, a look into a very secretive element of ufology that we would all love to know more of, but it's so difficult to find out information, as is a lot of things, like you've quite rightly and quite well covered from that Chinese perspective.
What I'll do is I'll link, I wrote an article on this, which I sent you, and I think it's publicly available on my website. If it isn't, I'll make it freely available. I'll give you the link. You can put it in the box below and people can just read it.
Awesome. Well, listen, Richard, once again, if folks haven't heard the last episode, they should go back and listen, where we talked about everything that's happening politically in the United States right now with the US conversation. And who knows, by the time this comes out, we could be knuckle deep in disclosure. You could be following up. AD could be a guidebook rather than a book about the possibilities come that point. Who knows? But obviously you're currently still doing Need to Know with Bryce Zabel, which is fantastic. Mm-hmm. I look forward to those episodes. Bryce has his new podcast out, folks. I forgot to mention Sound Like Frequency. Bryce and Brent will be on the podcast soon as well, hopefully, to discuss that. Your book, the second volume, is going to be out in the coming weeks from the release of this episode. Yeah.
Yes, that is true.
What's the best place for folk to get a hold of that, Richard?
I'll make it available on all of the platforms on Amazon, primarily. So hardcover, paperback, ebook, and audiobook will all be available there.
Brilliant.
And I'll have a link on my website as well.
Awesome. I've been asking guests this year, and I'd love to know, give me three predictions that you see coming this year for the UFO topic. Can be big or small.
Oh, predictions. No disclosure. I don't know. I don't even know if I can give you one prediction, honestly. I'm not seeing a breakthrough. What would be nice would be that, I'll say, if Trump's directive, let's call it that, gains any traction and is able to generate enough forward motion, maybe you could see something happen with the UAP Disclosure Act. And a best case scenario for me would be that that act gets passed in a more or less intact form. That would be something to look for. Because the fact is that that act is a potential great significance. It wouldn't be a panacea, but it would place this subject within the federal structure in a much more powerful way than it's for the public than it's ever been. So that would be something that I would like to see. And I don't want to say that's a prediction, but that would be something to look for. And that's about as far as I could probably go.
That's all for this episode of That UFO Podcast. Thank you so much for listening and watching. If you enjoyed the show, please follow, subscribe, and leave a rating or review wherever you get your podcast. It really helps others find the show. If you're watching on YouTube, hit like, subscribe, and turn on notifications so you don't miss future episodes. You can also support the show directly and get early access, ad-free episodes, and bonus content on Patreon or by subscribing on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube memberships. All the links are over at thatufopodcast.com or in the show description below, along with merchandise and more. Don't forget, you can also pick up a copy of my book, Atlas of Unidentified Flying Objects, available now in all good bookstores and through online retailers, including Amazon. Big thank you again to all of you for listening and tuning in. Until next time, keep looking up. You never know what you might see.
It wasn't a Tic Tac and not quite a saucer, more like a hubcap designed by Chaucer. A little baroque and quite steampunk, like Alice was playing bass for the Parliament of Funk. The little fucker hovered right outside of my window, and when I shoved out the screen, he made it an issue. I don't think he expected me to see his ass, but I'd had some champagne.